Brace yourselves, everybody. There's a storm coming. Poetic peeps and gentle persons, in-betweeners and non-conformers, genders all and genders equal, welcome to Eat the Storms, the poetry podcast. This is episode 4, season 8. I am Jamie B. Donnelly, your host and producer, and thank you so much for tuning in, whether that's on Spotify, Apple, Google, Breaker, Podbean, Player FM, Overcast, Pocket Cast, Castbox, Podcast Addicts, or iTunes. Today, we are settling down here in Ireland, in Wales, in the south of France, and also in Los Angeles in the United States. And one of my guests will join me at the end for Behind the Storms, the interview series examining the how, the why, and the what of poetry. How we got into it, why it captured us, and what have we done with it since. On today's show, we have exhibits of dog blankets, inflatable lathers. We run with racehorses and sheepdogs, catch the dusk with dairy cows, journey through the fog of what keeps us together and the things that find us in the darkness on the cold streets. So for the next 70 minutes, draw the curtains, light the candle, let the storms outside blow away while this poetic storm in here finds its wings. My name is Jamie B. Donnelly. This is Eat the Storms, a poetry podcast, and I hope you enjoy the show. For my first guest on the podcast today, and the guest who will be joining again at the end of today's show for Behind the Storms interview, I am delighted to welcome a storm trooper. Not only is she a regular guest every season, she is also a regular listener along with her wife Kath from their home in Wales, surrounded by Smurfs and very little dust. Aside from liking all kinds of coasts, the scent of ice cream freezers, and most importantly, peculiar things, she is also the author of the sensational debut collection Magnifying Glass, which came out in 2020 with Black Eyes Publishing. And later on this year, her second collection, Welcome to the Museum of Life, will be looking for a place in your hands and also on your bookshelf. So I hope you have a good biscuit or a decent slice of cake for the journey, because we're off to the Museum of Life with Sue Finch.
Hello, Damien. Thank you for having me back on Eat the Storms. As you know, it's one of my favourite podcasts. I've brought along 5 exhibits with me today. I've got a dog blanket, taxidermy models of a heron and a wolf, a hopscotch grid, an inflatable ladder that you shouldn't attempt to climb, and a large plate of soul cakes at the centre of a buffet table. So my new collection, Welcome to the Museum of a Life, is arranged in galleries, and I've chosen one exhibit from each gallery, and I'm going to read you the poem that goes with each of those exhibits. Thank you for listening. The first one's called A Garden Pond. I had never seen so many shades of darkness. Difficult to distinguish dark brown from burnished black. I was happy there, staring. My reflection stared back, rippled. I wanted to kiss it. I already knew there were countless versions of green, pure lime green, dark army green, fairy tale frog green, the endless mixing in of yellow. A snail with an algaed shell moved as if in outer space. I was close to gripping it. Then I was right in there, amongst bouncy pondweed, straggly ribbons of leaves, and those shades of brown and black in close-up. Oh, the depths of it! I was so cold amongst the stale green smell, but happy. They shouldn't have ripped me from it, just to wrap me in a stranger's dog blanket. Rough wool held me silent all the way home. The air had chilled me to the bone. Grey dog hairs stuck to my lips. Gallery 2 features this poem. I hate you, said the cow. Yeah, she hates you, whispered the grass. Hates you, It swished on and on. So I climbed the gate. "Get off, you're too heavy," said the gate. "Yeah, you're going to break us," said the padlock on the chain. I stepped over a large muddy puddle. Marv ordered a greeny brown cowpat. Imagine creating that. Then I remembered that the cow hated me, and I ditched my admiration. "Stop looking at me, and notice how quiet it is, stupid," said the cowpat. I lifted my head to the clouds, caught the eye of a bird I couldn't name, saw its beak begin to open. I wondered if the silence would shatter, like a pint glass, all splinters and nibs, or just quietly split down the middle, like surface ice on a pond. "There's only one of you." The unknown bird was staring at me. I waited for it to cock its head. It remained still, a totem carved in the tree. "You want me to repeat that, don't you?" mocked a heron standing on the path. "You think I have ancient grey wisdom and the key to solitude." I did. I wanted to keep going, but as his wings opened like a prayer, I froze. This poem's called Hopscotch. The numbers should be in a straight line, like a road, or left to right with a zero at the centre. Hopscotch in them is wrong. It's not even that the odd ones make a pattern for your feet to land on. You say I should be throwing a stone to tell me where to jump to, that just going from 1 to 10 is not how it's done. I don't tell you I'm only doing it because it's there, or that I think using a stone is wrong. I like the smoothness of dice and counters, the satisfaction of rolling fair-weighted ones. It worries me that the squares aren't square, and what of the chalk with its impermanence? I fear I cannot hopscotch with you. "It's okay if you don't want to play," you were saying. "I understand." But I don't want you to understand. I want you to change the game, adapt the rules and make it better. "I'll play," I tell you. "Just don't make it stop at 10. Make it last longer. Make the squares as square as you can. Go to 100 and find me the smoothest pebble possible." "We can't use a stone if it goes to 100. You tell me, as you pocket the chalk. And this poem's called Hanging On. Sure of the rope that had me swinging, certain the rungs were wooden, I thought of the grip of past climbers, all the dirt pushed into the twists, smoothed and darkened by person after person. And here I am, 3/4 of the way up, suddenly swaying on unanchored plastic, the realisation that the ladder is inflatable. I cling on, tell myself height is irrelevant, that I was ascending before. Say if hand over hand worked a few feet in the air, there is no reason to doubt it now. I will the sway to stop, keep listening. I go faster, desperate to outclimb that gentle puff of escaping air. And the final poem's called When I Am Gone. Serve soul cakes. Sprinkle dried green lettuce on salty crackers. Plate up purple and orange macaroons, yellow too, if it pleases you. Spear black olives onto cocktail sticks. Put out far too many bottles of red wine. Spend an hour of your morning cracking almonds into small bowls. Sweep up the debris with your hands. Let each fruit be a memory, but watch out for the bitter ones. Everything should fit mouths that are not hinged to be wide, have potential to be slipped in nonchalantly between tails that bring out hard laughter. Except apples. They will let you watch for who bites right in, who takes a knife to them, who puts 2 in their bag for later. At the end, if a soul cake remains on that table, take it to the coast. Await the interest of gulls, then toss it decidedly upwards. Let the cries fill the air. I enjoyed reading those, and I hope you enjoyed listening. If you want to know why there was a wolf, you'll have to buy the book. Thank you.
For my next guest, we are moving from Wales and coming back to Ireland and welcoming a first-time guest to Eat the Storms, whose debut poetry collection, In Spring We Turn to Water, will be published later this year by Dara Press. I recently heard him read at Lime Square Poets, the Thursday night Zoom sensation, and I immediately added him to my guest wish list. You've probably read his poetry in places like The Banshee, The Irish Independent, Poetry Ireland Review, and last year he was the featured poet in the summer edition of The Stinging Fly. Today I'm delighted to welcome to Eat the Storms for the first time, reading from that upcoming collection, this is Michael Dooley.
My name is Michael Dooley. I'm incredibly grateful to have the opportunity to read on Damien's wonderful podcast, Eat the Storms. I'm going to read a few poems from my debut collection, In Spring We Turn to Water, which is published by Dara Press later this year. This first poem is called Sweet Pea. It was originally published in Banshee. When I was a much younger person, I worked with racehorses for many years. Sweet pea. We bounce to gallops at dawn, blooded cuticles of my fingers twirling in the wire brush mane. I call her Sweet Pea, because when she was born, she climbed up and blossomed. Now, her leg is a broken October stalk, wrecked as a child's straw. The vet prepares his gun. I lean down to calm her, wet bridle in my hands. When her poll breaks out in flower, the mane in olive pods, before I reach to touch them, she straightens with a pluck. This next poem was originally published in Bear Fiction in the UK around 2015, I think. It's called Eelock. Wind brought the cry off the hill. Its cat scratch and tin scrape rubbed up and over the leg of night. A blackthorn switch peeled too quick. He stood stumped against charged, frothy beasts sieved from the herd for slaughter. Took the language of milk before all others. He was leaned upon and woven to a sentient grass which shadowed his father's people from Mayo to set folkloric curses under the boy's foot to clutch it as he came to age. Mascard saw his sleep. His wallet, thick with prayers, spent in fear they'd leave it to the sister's son instead of him. Shoulders hooped by bucket draws, eyes averted in pub talk of women. He was a barometer, arched for rain. A call to patient sheepdogs, unaccounted for at night. This next poem was originally published in Poetry Ireland Review. Peninsula at night. He swore he'd seen her drink from the teat of a cow, and she was a hare then, or a witch. A sea stack pops its head above the swell, lights again in the rear view mirror. Loop head roads wind in narrow buckles like hawthorn or chine of dying sheep. Horses could not pull from him the thought of her. In the doorway, she listens against the quietness, the Atlantic bubbling like a sleeping child, stone teething through soil, a snitch, snitch, snitch of cattle grazing in darkness, the hinge of a gate on a windless night, the questioning of herself, a low growl from the dog. This poem is set in a place that's very important to me. A flat land in the middle of County Limerick, around Brofin Atlaca, called the Rathcannon Carcass. This poem first appeared in The Stinging Fly, Meadow at Dusk. There's a herd of dairy cows in the 9 acres tonight. It is dusk, midsummer. Everything is alive and growing. It is so hot, you breathe with your skin. I'm walking home from the river with hands that smell of trout. Meadow foxtail covers the tongues of my boots like cortege flowers. One by one, cows begin to fold and fall in the evening sun until eventually the long field looks like an abandoned game of chess. I close my eyes and listen to the rip of grass stalks, the grinding of cud, a magic regularity like soldiers on the move. When I open them, there is a hare standing in a gap between the cows, head high in the evening air, frame as still as a post. I want to beat my foot on the dried out soil to squeal a cry of danger, glint between the bitter dock, find some shadow in which to slip my form. I stand so still, I begin to forget what I am. Everywhere there is restlessness. Leaves tighten, daisies narrow in the dark. I know that if I close my eyes again, I may not leave this field. I was a very small kid. I was sent out to the blockhouse to get some timber for the fire some winter. It was maybe 7 or 8. And as I was trying to free these blocks from the pile, something caught my eye. And it transpired that it was the base of an antler of a giant Irish deer, Megaloceros giganteus, which would have lived in the area between 9 and 11,000 years ago, and which was exhumed, I guess you could call it, throughout the arterial drainage scheme, the end of the 70s and the early 80s. Redux in the blockhouse. It was in the timber shed as a boy that you found the antlers. Poking from under a pile of blocks, a stench of coniophora rot, a strange ripple that said not cattle bone, but Pleistocenic deer. You heaved them free and slipped, sent the kettle nest of a robin tumbling, its ochre egg loosened into the nooks of the stack, dropping and clacking like a pinball, a ring in a drain, a potted white. And at night, you dreamt the car length of your head trapped you in woodlands where you'd fled. Hard-footing bracken and last willow, twigs that made their tinder crackle long after you had passed. You could hear the stream in which you wanted to wash the rottish stench, to hide you as you passed in juniper, sorrel by the musk of a badger set. but the leaves have thinned for you to better see your coming end. Bay and twisted step of dog, the sun touching blades of running men, you blare when the first teeth pierce the soft below your barrow. See yourself cut and portioned, your crown pulled by oxen to fallow ground, a robin dressing your sockets with lichen moss and tufted grass. And when you rose in the morning, picking clover from your teeth, you saw in the bathroom mirror the nest eggs clear as Jupiter's, trembling, gassing, cracking from your eye. Thank you again to Damien for this singular opportunity.
We are going stateside now and settling down in Los Angeles for a writer and the author of the poetry chapbook, The Space Carved by the Sharpness of Your Absence, which was published by Gyroscope Press in 2022. In 2020, she was the winner of the Aurora Poetry Contest, and previous publications have included Glassworks, The Ekphrastic Review, The Baltimore Review, Swim, and Sheila and Gig. She is a longtime volunteer at Write Girl and has mentored teens through writing workshops and in a juvenile detention center. Joining us today with a BA from Union College in Schenectady, New York, and memories of journeys to Ireland, I'm pleased to welcome to the podcast for the first time, Nancy Murphy.
Hi, this is Nancy Murphy, and I'm talking to you from Los Angeles. Thank you, Damien, for including me in your podcast. I've really enjoyed the wide range of voices that you feature. I'm honored to be part of this. I'm originally from Boston, and I have all Irish ancestry on both sides, so I do have a particular affinity with Ireland. I've visited many times, and I usually come back with a new poem or two. I have four Irish-inspired poems in my new chapbook, and I'm going to read one of these to start. And this one, I'll say, was written about a trip that we took in summer that was particularly cold. I believe it was 22. So it's called It's a Long Way. From Cahersaveen to Galway, we start in the morning, head north. I read him directions from my phone as he shifts the gears of the tiny red Renault. How smooth the ride feels, considering how he handles an automatic. I speak clearly and slowly and with an Irish accent for no reason except that it feels truer. Sometimes he hears me, makes the correct turn. Other times he doesn't hear me because he's thinking. This difference between us a constant. I understand it. I don't like it. Fog slips in, spills out over tops of shaggy hedges, moves in and out of forest like the quietest army. Gray skies reflected in the lakes and bays and estuaries and ocean we pass. Then drizzle, wipers on and off, uneven this rain and not rainness. Our first night, the soft swoosh of showers lulled us to sleep. Waking in a fog a few hours later, strange, half-dreaming, jet lag, I suppose. It's been like that this week. Cloudy with bright cerulean patches and blinding sun. Minutes later, a multitude of black swirls, some touching the water with a frizzle of rain. Their darkness screams across the bay towards us as we run back to the car. The wind, too, punishing at the sharp cliffs, then a quiet break. We need to be here, to remember what keeps us together, to spend hours in a car where the silence slices both ways. As we continue, We find a 7th century church on an unplanned, lost again road. A welcome hot tea cart at a chilly beach. Plump oysters just plucked from the stony sea. And always the comfort of the green. On the emerald pastures we whip past, on the mossy stone walls that chase us along the narrow byways, and on the tall trees that gather and reach over us, hold us in a verdant tunnel of their making, we feel a blessing as we pass under. We carry it with us. Late now, but still light in this far north summer. And this next poem was in a Swim journal originally, excuse me, and it's called Dimming. Let me tell you about leaving, how it was almost easy. Sometimes a mandarin is so ripe that its skin wants to be peeled, falls away as your fingers get close, pockets of air under the surface, waiting for release. I was ready like that, open to other hands, mouths, scents. I feared being skipped over, not picked in time, frostbite. At first it was a long December. Then it was spring in my step. Everyone noticed. Still, I buried a guilt that I could have done better, that maybe I had no right to ripen. I had a secret tally of faults that I used against myself like a rainstorm. I made judges out of accidental men, took punishment hungrily, until it was enough. Only then could I let myself look back, see how smugly we walked the streets of Philadelphia, wrapped with each other, wrapped around each other. Then baby daughter mornings in the corner condo, LA beach sun streaming in, smells of talcum. Remember I said almost. We were once a light, he and I. What did we know then of dimming? All right, and this last one that I'm going to read is kind of a hybrid. It's set in Ireland, but it's not really about Ireland. My first trip to Dublin, I was a student in Bath, England, doing a study abroad, and I took a long weekend by myself to Dublin. So this has some memories of that. This is called Heat and Other Burnings. I love the way the body burns within from forward motion in winter. In Dublin, I watch a young girl weaving around slow walkers, jumping across narrow streets as buses bear down, stepping into a basement coffee house. She sheds her heavy coat and the woolen scarf wrapped around her wet mouth and innocence. Her heat and secrets release into the room all at once, the smell a mix of sweat, sandalwood, and recklessness. A girl tries to keep her secrets close. They are the mistakes she yearns to make. A woman knows the currency of confession, what it can buy, how you pay, how it frees you. The girl is on the left side of virginity, itching to cross a line, soon to be awakened, well, soon to act like she is awake. It isn't a lie exactly, but I want to tell her it takes a woman a lifetime to know if she is real or only appears so in a mirror. The reflection is only skin deep, cool as glass. Look into the eyes. Sadness first lands there, then the jaw, and then the line of the lips. All right. Thank you. Thank you for listening. Thanks again, Damien. Bye.
From the United States, we are now coming back to Europe for a British poet who grew up in Gloucester before spending 8 years studying in London, working with the homeless, and now lives in the south of France with his family, concentrating on writing, teaching English, and community building. Today, he'll be sharing poems from his debut collection, An Array of Vapour, which is available from TSL Publications. With work forthcoming in places like Door is Ajar magazine, The Hogley Review, Fair Forward and Foreshadow magazine, and a second collection on the way called A Handful of Prayers, I'm very pleased to hand you over to Peter Lilly.
Hello, my name is Peter Lilly, and I'm going to read some poems from my debut collection, which is called An Array of Vapour and is out now with TSL Publications. I'd really like to thank Damien for the opportunity to share these poems with you, and I hope you enjoy them. This book was written in response to 5 years I spent working in various frontline roles for a homelessness charity in Watford, just northwest of London. The charity is called New Hope, and the book travels through different areas that homeless people find themselves struggling against every single day, starting with the darkest area of suicide and premature death, working through areas of mental health difficulties, substance misuse, institutionalization, and the physical struggle of just living outside in the cold. And the book as a whole and each section in the book works through darkness towards light, and a final section on recovery. The first poem I would like to read is from that first section, which deals with suicide, so I'm going to give a trigger warning. If you struggle with suicidal ideation, or you feel that you might find a poetic account of someone who tried to end their own life to be disturbing or unhelpful for you at this time, you might want to skip forward by about 1 minute and 50 seconds from here. If you're still listening, this poem is called Eyes, and it was first published in Season 6, Number 5 of the wonderful Scottish journal, Drich. So thank you to Jack Caradoc for publishing this for the first time. Eyes. That night, you persistently asked leading questions about nothing. They were leading downwards, and there I was trying to phrase an elusive answer, while you were trying to find a reason to breathe. The next morning, you had two pairs of eyes, one attempting to look so determined, glinting as they darted up and down the corridor, like something untamed meeting unnatural torchlight. You told me I needed to call the police, that this time they needed to take you away. The other pair was static and unmistakably dead. 999, we dialed a third time in 8 hours. Colour slowly drained from your face as we started the compressions. I felt your ribcage crack as we fought for breath you did not want. I checked your throat for blockages, noticing your missing teeth, remembering your last hot meal, the charity of a well-meaning bystander who promptly moved on. I can still see your motionless tongue and those eyes already gone. Welcome back to those who found it better to avoid that previous poem. The second poem I'd like to read is called Drizzle. Wattled days, damp and dense, hang from the mildewed wall of time like wet wallpaper, so full of what would be thirsted for if it wasn't for the constant drizzle. There is a loneliness you can only feel when your socks are soaked cold and throaty. It makes sure you know your place and that your place is not habitable. That your place is a time and that time is past and passing further into the drifting mist like uneven milestones, the visual whispers of a silhouette pilgrim. The echo of the scramble of tired boots on loose scree, the order of gravity bullying with lies of entropy. In blind ascent, faith is all, every footfall. Now I'd like to read a villanelle called Light Sources Number 2 that was first published in Lothlorien Poetry Journal Volume 7. So thank you to Strider Marcus Jones for including the poem in that. Light Sources Number 2. I duck below the blows of constant fight, beneath the ever-present burning gaze, to shiver before the warm starlight. Our corneas contain competition, our lenses tinted with a violent malaise. I duck below the blows of constant fight, prostrate, as if in humble contrition. Yet looking up, one can escape this maze to shiver before the warm starlight. And amid the frenzied acquisition, in stillness before the ethereal blaze, I duck below the blows of constant fight. I stoop beneath my prescribed volition, relinquish the script planning out my days to shiver before the warm starlight. Letting dew dampen my ignition, cooling from the ravaging, raging rays, I duck below the blows of constant fight to shiver before the warm starlight. Hopefully you can feel the movement from darkness and difficulty towards a light of hope and freedom as I go through this collection. The next poem I'd like to read is a sonnet called Learning to Move. Scars are the cement of my skin, and I dissolve in the thick liquid of her gaze. I wait for opportunities that rise and fall, always backing the wrong future. I collect fool's rocks with a golden glaze and willfully chase the spaces between dreams. Scars are the proofs of yesterday's suture, and I dissolve in the grey of endless waiting. Conflicted with one foot beyond the seam, planted in tomorrow's shifting shadows. But now I dissolve in truth, sedating the stubborn ambitions of my ego. I dissolve. I lose my fear of drowning. I can move, feel the unknown future's crowning. The last poem I'd like to read is from the final section of the book. The poem is called Made, and it was actually the first poem of mine that was ever published on paper. I'm really thankful to Isabel Kenyon of Fly on the Wall Press for including this in the anthology Please Hear What I'm Not Saying. Made. Yellow teeth have tasted tobacco, scarred skin has felt the knife, grey hairs have withstood life, fearfully and wonderfully weathered. Calloused fingers have pressed the strings, cracked bones have tried utterly, bruised wrists have broken free, fearfully and wonderfully blemished. Faltering feet know they have strayed. Dejected eyes have been accused, yet contrite hearts shall not be refused. Fearfully and wonderfully stained. Secure voices can resonate devotion. Crooked limbs have been reset. Repeating lips do not forget. Fearfully and wonderfully remade. That's all from me. Thank you so much for listening, and big thank you to Damien for including me in the podcast. Be blessed and all the best. Bye bye.
And now, Before we proceed, I would like to advise you to please finish up eating and make sure you leave all drinks outside. It's time for a museum visit behind the storms. So I am thrilled today to have with us from behind the scenes Sue Finch, who you've already heard on the podcast earlier on. She is originally from Kent in the United Kingdom, but now living in Wales with her wife, Kat, a fine collection of Smurfs, a stuffed teddy called Ronnie, more about that later, and an addiction to lost elastic bands. Sue is one of the most important supporters of the podcast and also one of my most welcomed returning guests. She has also now been a two-time contributing writer to the Storms Journal, which makes me so incredibly happy and honoured. And of course, her work has been featured in a range of journals, including places like A New Manchester Alphabet, One Hand Clapping, Ink, Sweat and Tears, The Poetry Bus, and most recently, the Whiskey Tree Anthology from Broken Spine Arts. Formerly a primary school teacher and also a head teacher, and now coach and mentor, but today, of course, here as a poet. Sue is the author of Magnifying Glass, which was published by Black Eyes Publishing in 2020, which many of our listeners will already be very familiar with, and upcoming the new collection, Welcome to the Museum of Life. She is also a frequent dazzler on YouTube, sharing her poems and insights, and now also with her own podcast since 2023, available on Podbean, called Singing as the Darkness Lifts. This is where she brings us new scents, new musings, and poetic treats on Monday mornings. Sue, thank you so much for taking the time to join us here today.
Thank you for having me, Damien. It's a bit of a pleasure. I think you know that.
Yes, I do know that. But a season of the podcast would not be complete if you were not taking part. Now, I know yourself and Kath always listening, but having you on it, it's what makes every season. And thank you so much for that.
Yeah, it's a pleasure because you put back Saturday afternoons for us. We've eaten a lot of cake because there has to be cake when it's on. That ritual of its time, and I do always try and tune in at exactly 5 o'clock. If I miss it, I kick myself if I'm even a bit late, but it can be challenging. I've had some interesting small cakes in a Premier Inn, for example, which wouldn't be my normal choice, but it's one of my favourite places to be is on your podcast or listening to it.
Well, thank you so much. And I have to say thank you also for the photographs, because almost every week, every Saturday, just before 5, I get to see what you and Kath are going to share in terms of a treat, because it's on a fantastic plate, you know, whether it's a cookie, whether it's a cake, you perfectly share it with the audience. So thank you so much for that. The whole point of this, of these chats, these casual little chats, are about beginnings and, you know, how, why did you get involved with poetry? How did it take over your life? Whether was there a specific person, was there a specific influence, or was it a gradual process?
Yeah, so you've just transported me back to probably when I was 10, because if anybody ever asks me how did I get into poetry, I really think the time I came home from school and read a poem to my brother. Well, I probably told it to him. I'd memorized it at the time. And he said I couldn't possibly have written it. It was a cracking poem called Harvest Time. And it rhymed some really bad rhymes in it. But I said it to him and he said, no, you didn't write that. And I said, but I did. I'd spent the afternoon sitting in a class, looking out the window on a sunny day, thinking about things that are in harvest. And then the teachers at the school said to me that I needed to read it at Harvest Festival, which was a thing. We walked down to the church. My mum and my nan were going to be in the audience. And all I can actually remember, apart from my brother saying it was a good poem, is sitting in a pew and one of the teachers, not my teacher, just looked at me, took hold of my hands and rolled up my sleeves because my jumper was either too long or, as my mum would have said, I probably had chewed the ends of my sleeve. So she either rolled them up because it didn't fit me properly, or she could see I'd chewed my sleeves and it wasn't appropriate for church. So at that time, I would say to you now, I bet I was confident, right, standing up there reading that poem because I thought it was good. Then I would write stuff. I did at university, I wrote stuff. I was famous for sitting in a room with my college mates and I would be counting my syllables on my nose. putting my finger on my nose, listening to Leonard Cohen and
Oh.
checking my syllables in my lines. And I wrote some good stuff then, but it was college, and that's what we were doing. So I was training to be a teacher for doing that. And then I probably didn't do a lot when I was being a head teacher. So there came a point, I think it was probably 2015, I can't quite remember, when I thought, I'm missing me. There's something about me that is not here anymore. And I think it was poetry. So I thought, what can I do? And I decided to do an MA simply because if I studied on a Monday and Tuesday and made myself do it, it would be something to come home to for me. So I'm not quite sure how I fitted it in now. And Kath always says she earned the dots in my MA because she would read my essays and correct any punctuation that might need punctuating. So when we had our champagne to celebrate it, we were toasting my achievement and the dot. So that's it, really. And then I had a confidence of crisis. I liked what I was putting on the page, but wanted to see it in the world and wasn't ever sure I was going to find an audience. So I got to a point where I was really doing it for me and really proud of finding that time, but didn't quite know what to do with the poems, if that makes sense.
And it
And
was a New Manchester Alphabet. Was that the first time that you were ever published? Was that?
yes, so I had something called A Door Closes. You know, those funny competitions you get where you all have to buy the book. So in my youth, sort of early 20s, I wrote, and it is good, it's a good enough poem, but it's one of those ones where they put together the anthology and they hope you've got like great auntie, this, that, and the other up the road who want to buy a
You're going to buy
copy.
it.
So that was a good poem. So that was published in a way. But yeah, my proper publication was that one, Graphene. So we were, some people had already grabbed a letter of the alphabet. So I can't quite remember how I got G for Graphene. But I do remember my poor brother comes up in all of this. I texted him and I said, what, he's a scientist. What can you tell me about graphene? So I got this little set of things on a text message which told me a bit more about graphene, and I thought, oh, okay, I can do something with that. So he's been quite instrumental in my poetry, but I crafted it a bit after that, and then there was an illustrator. So somebody illustrated it, we wrote the poems, and then there was a launch, and nobody could come. Kath was busy, so Georgie and a few people that I studied with were there. But that was quite brave for me to go to a big city.
Well, it's funny as you say that you record yourself reading poems, and they're on YouTube. You also now have your own podcast. We'll talk about that in a moment. But in terms of the YouTube videos, the thing that always brings me joy is before you start the poem, because sometimes the poem is literally about chopping off part of your finger. But the thing that brings me joy is seeing your face when you start to read, because I think for me, the thing that you do is that you don't just write a poem and put it on the page. I can see that you want to share the poem, express the poem. And by doing that, by recording it, we get this deeper insight into the poem itself. You know, we get your intonations, the stresses, the breaths. You think about that consciously.
So the reason it started was because I really struggle with my confidence. So I thought, what's one way of doing that? If you're me and you're scared of putting yourself in the world, then one of the biggest things you can do is actually video yourself doing something. So that's how it started. There have been, I can do what I call now one take Sue. So I can sit down, breathe, and inhabit the beginning of the poem, and then I just go for it because I want to be read. So I know that's not being read, it's being seen. But I want my work out there. And my sister always used to say to me, you can't hanker to be a poet that people read if you're not ever going to read your poems to them. So that makes me laugh as well. So now I'd say, because I've been doing it for quite some time, it was one a month got me through lockdown. And it was also a way of keeping in touch with my family, because if my mum wanted to see me read a poem, she could go on YouTube and have a look. But now I can do it. So I can, the whole point is to sit somewhere and just be in the moment of that poem. So it's a bit selfish, really, I suppose, to inhabit your own work. But I like the fact that you think that there's something in that as well. And people do watch them, and that's okay, isn't it? It doesn't have to be a big audience. It just needs to be for me and for somebody else. So I'm really proud of how it's developed. But it was all really designed to help me try and find my voice as well as get myself out there, because I want to be out there.
But I think it's all, I've noticed sort of over the podcast, and it's funny because when I originally started the podcast, I was having panic attacks. And at one point I thought, why am I doing a podcast? But over the course of doing it, the thing that I've learned is that reading a poem is very different. And even if it's a poem that I'm still working on, if I read it out loud and if I trip over a word, more often than not, it's a word that's wrong, or it's a word that doesn't quite fit, or it isn't quite there, or the line isn't quite there. When I read a poem and it's sort of first taken, it's all the way through, and I'm happy with it, and I know where the breaths and the pauses are, I think, oh, okay. But what I've begun to learn now is just by reading things and recording myself, even if it doesn't go out there, or even if it's just me listening, it's my way of hearing what it sounds like, and then what would it sound like in somebody else's ear.
Yeah, and I've always admired you from the first time we shared a Zoom room, and you deliver your work so well. And I was thinking, oh, one day I'll be a bit like Damien. But we have Poetry Corner here. So Kath will say, have you written something new? She'll go and sit in one chair. Well, I'll be sitting here and read it to her. Yeah. And that gives me the find the stumble words or the bits that I can't actually say. So that helps. There was one time I was recording, you know, the Museum of a Life poem, which was actually going somewhere. It wasn't just for my YouTube thing. I was in this room. This is hilarious. And I'll tell you now, because I might as well have started. I was in this room for 50 minutes. Okay. And then I kept going in and out. There was a time I opened the door and I went stomping up to Kath's study and I said, do you know what? It doesn't matter whether I like the flipping poem or not. I just need to read it, because what I was trying to do was say something at the beginning, like, I like something or other. And she was in stitches, really. But it was, I think it was 2 pints of water and 50 minutes. So I'm a bit better than that now.
I have to say, honestly, and it's not a joke, and it's not me trying to build you up, but when I do watch you reading, I find that, to me, you go into this place of calmness, and then you take on the poem. And I've always admired that. Whereas I think, where I have to read, I'm trying to catch a breath, and I'm thinking, oh, I'm getting flushed now, and I'm all red, and you know, I'm worried that that's all going to come across on the screen. It's funny, when we're on our Zoom screens, we have the protection of, you know, really, we're just in our little houses on our own, talking to our computers and, you know, in control of the lighting and the sound. But then you forget that other people are listening in and other people are watching. So Sue, you are also now podcast host and producer. You have your own show currently on Podbean called Singing As the Darkness Lifts. How did this come about? Why did this come about? And tell me all the smells that we're going to be hearing on Monday mornings, or discovering on Monday mornings. I hope they're good smells.
Yeah, so do I. I dread the day that it's really terrible, Damien, when I wake up on a Monday. So
you do have a penchant for peculiar, though, so.
Yeah, so it's all right, really. Anything will go. It's got to be authentic. So it started in September, because I was doing a change of career, so training to be a life coach, stepping out of head teacher land. But what I wanted to do, one thing that was really important to me, was have Monday mornings for me. I used to be absolutely exhausted on a Friday night, and sometimes the thought of going to work on a Monday without enough energy felt horrible, for want of a better word. So I thought, I'm going to reclaim Mondays. And I needed a hook. And I thought, actually, I do have a good sense of smell ever since I had my head in that freezer when I was about 6, lost in the supermarket with my head down by the Fabs and enjoying the smell so much I lost my mum. So I thought, I'll do that, because I used to notice what was on my drives to work. And I really like to see what the air smells like. And it has been different. I think when I'm talking to you now, I'm on episode 21. Mm-hmm. And the smell of Monday morning has been different every single week. And it's surprised me and entertained me. So that's always my start. And then I think I was holding myself accountable. Is this new life going to be different? Will I be authentic? Am I actually going to find this authentic Sue that I reckon is still there and, you know, worth cultivating? So I was holding myself accountable. So I was writing it as a blog. And then I thought, hold on a minute, you're missing a trick here, because you're still writing, you're putting things on the page. So if you want to be what you say you're going to be, the best version of yourself, you're going to need to say this out loud and then see if people want to hear it. And also, it's good. I think there are people who prefer to be read to like my sister likes a bedtime story, people who like that more than reading. So then I thought, there's all these great people with podcasts out there. What about if I give that a go? So some episodes are like 3 minutes long, some are seven, and some will resonate with people and some will just go, what is she going on about now? But I really like it, and it has. I've listened to it all in one go because I am peculiar. So that when I got to an hour, I sat here one day with a cup of tea and listened to it all. And you know what? I could hear my journey from September exhaustion to gradually, and that's why it's called Singing as the Darkness Lifts, for the birds at dawn and for that mental health journey of let's see what goes on.
But again, it's about journeys, and that's what you do so well. I want to talk to you about your collections, because Anna Saunders, dear poet, fantastic poet, and the founder of Cheltenham Poetry Festival, said that to read Sue Finch is to be transported to other worlds, worlds in which the everyday is transported into the stuff of myth and legend. And to me, that is definitely what it's like to dive into your work all the way through Magnifying Glass. There are journeys, trips, tripping out sometimes reality into fantasy, but it's all grounded in this realness. A journey, especially with Magnifying Glass, a journey through life. Even if the second poem perhaps wants to journey back into the womb, but that's the whole other story. And a brilliant poem as you're reading through it. But your new collection, Welcome to the Museum of Life, coming out later this year, it certainly continues on that, but I think possibly on a far grander scale. I got the chance to read it in advance. Thank you so much for that. And it is, I think, Dali-esque in its scope and in its dreamscape. But again, it's grounded in the ponds, the pitfalls, the pandemics, the plethora of birds, all laid out like a seasoned curator would in an actual museum. So I was wondering maybe if you could tell us about this life that you're putting on display, and also the cheeky things that you haven't put on display but yet are still cleverly acknowledged in the book itself.
Okay, it is that zooming in, and I'd got a few poems that I was really proud of. Mm-hmm. And I thought, is there a collection in this? And I couldn't see anything at first that would tie them together. And then I thought, oh, do you know what I'm exhibiting? These are all exhibits. So then I began to picture it. I can actually picture in my head these things in a museum. I think that would be a cracking museum. From the inflatable ladder, there was more to be said. So what I'd set down in Magnifying Glass was important to me. I needed to stop and take stock. I wanted a book in the world. And then if by doing that, I felt I could go forward. So then when I got these other poems and I looked at them, I thought, oh, do you know what? A child once said to me, I bought you this. It's a beautiful rabbit, like out of Alice in Wonderland, figurine. And she said, I bought it for you because you like peculiar things. And I thought, I've always liked peculiar things. And so that zooming in on the different parts. So obviously there's still a dead rabbit. There's still plenty to be said about that kind of thing in my work. That's going to probably come up again and again. But that's how it came about. And then I'd missed things from my childhood. So I've got like a massive jar of Smurfs now. When I was little, I would have, I can't remember how many I had, but I had some. And then I got to this, a few years ago, and I thought, I miss some of those things from my childhood. So I would look for them, and then you gradually, you know, if you're me, you find them or people buy them for you. But I hate dusting, so I can't have things around my house that are going to gather dust. Well, I can, but I'm never going to dust them. So I put them in jars. And then that led to that dream I had, where it was a cracking dream, and it is that poem where I dreamt that Kath had got this crane in the back garden. She'd summoned me out there and she said, you know, you're going to become the exhibit. And probably from there, everything came together. So I was keen not to include anything that was really tentative. I think it does gel. But the interesting thing is it's still got a chronology to it. If you've lived my life like I have, there's still that childhood. And this one obviously goes right to the Death Watch Beatles or the buffet table and, you know, looking at that. But again, that was in Magnifying Glass. So I think it's just quirkier, the peculiar is in there, but it's definitely bits of me.
I was listening to your video today and I think you were reading Her Skin from the Storms. Thank you very much for being such a fantastic contributor. Again, it's always a joy to turn the page and see your name, your poem in it, because I'm a huge admirer. But what you said was there's always another part of the story. So always another angle to view it from, this endless inspiration from the same moment, the same incident, the same memory. And that's incredible because I think a lot of people think, well, I wrote about that and there we go. But you fascinate me because you thrive at re-examining.
Yeah, and sometimes it feels important to do it. I can see a different angle. And I don't think I've ever been scared of getting all the feeling and the angles out there. But I think the older I get, the more I want to look at it from the craftier angles, the darker angles, or really admit, you know, some of those things that were going on. My poor friend Julie gets traumatized every time I say there's another poem about chopping off the end of my finger, because it was her house I was staying in.
No.
But I always say, but it is so me. It is so good that it happened. It was horrible at the time, but it gave me that thing to think about. And then when you listen to what other people say about moments in your past and you think, crikey, they saw it from that angle, that might be important, or I didn't even think of it like that. Like my mum saying, oh, I cried because you weren't perfect. Mm-hmm. Now, it's lovely that she's honest enough to be able to say that. So she was sad that I was in pain, but that feeling, and I think I love it in other people's poetry, the curiosity for what are they going through, you know, the unique to the universal, and just seeing it. And I think if anybody can be fascinated by my story, that's super cool.
And you do peculiar so well, but what you do, and that's what I sort of meant in sort of this sort of Dali-esque dreamscape, that you do it for the reader in such a, we put such a trust in you. I feel that when you write about something, you're not necessarily a cathartic experience that you're trying to heal. I feel like, you know, regardless of what it is, the healing is there. It's just an understanding of what that moment was like then, what that moment was like yesterday, what that moment's going to be like tomorrow. You do it with such a wit, but a cleverness to it. But everyone is a journey with you, and everyone has a craft and a consideration that sometimes is quite rare. I've read your poems, and in the storms are blind submissions. But the first time you submitted, I thought, I see that craft. And that is a huge testament to you as a poet, as a writer.
Yeah, and somebody else said that. I was in a poetry workshop once, and they just said that they would know a Sue Finch poem. And I thought, oh, now that's what we want, isn't it? I'll take that.
How difficult or challenging was this one to put together in comparison with Magnifying Glass? Because this one, you know, it is laid out as a museum visit.
Yeah, I think it wasn't difficult. My only worry was, you know, there's a gift shop at the end. We don't want anybody, like I do at some of the properties that I go to look around. We don't want anybody hankering just for the tea towel and the bit at the end. So that was a nice feeling, because I am quite unique. If you take me out for a day and show me something nice, I can see it quite quickly. And I do want the tea towel and the jar of jam at the end. But I think sorting out the galleries was interesting. And to have that one about the dreams, which sort of came from the lockdown poems that came from my dreams. They actually, a lot of those were just things filtered out of my head. And I used to love it. I'd wake up in the morning and think, I'll just go and jot something in my journal because that could be a poem. So they needed a gallery of their own. The one where I wanted to go back to childhood, like falling in the pond, that needed to be at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And I quite liked my Death Watch Beatles poem, so that had to be in the end, and there's always going to be something like that. So I think I can picture it. I can picture the entrance to that museum and then taking somebody through. I just want them to linger. But like any good museum, they're going to like some things more than the others, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. I've been to your museum and I will be returning to the museum. I'd like to get an annual card to the museum. I hope it comes at a discount. But there are sections where I was more drawn to, but there is a journey throughout the entire thing in the same way as Magnifying Glass, and you've set it out with there's a beginning, a middle and an end, but throughout all that you can go back and review the parts and the pieces that intrigued you the most perhaps. But huge congratulations, it's an astonishing second collection.
Thank you.
Sue, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, you're a star. Thank you.
And remember that, I'm going to steal a line from one of your poems, you are glorious.
Oh, thank you, Damien.
And now, just before we finish up, I'm going to leave you with one poem. And today I decided, because Sue brought us to the museum and Peter read poems based on the streets of London, I decided to read a poem that was inspired by my gallery visits to the National Gallery in London when I lived there. And this particular poem inspired by The Sunflowers by Vincent van Gogh. It appeared in my Stickleback Micro Collection published by the Hedgehog Poetry Press in 2021. This is called Van Gogh Visions. Sometimes I stopped by to sit and wonder how you didn't change, while I clung to the edge of the seat to keep myself within the skin I was shedding, like those petals hanging onto your brushstrokes, though they never met the finality of their fate. Octopus-like tentacles vaulting from vase, too heavy to be held upright, sagging as I did when I came in. When I came to that seat with the city rushing in after, up the tourist-trodden steps, panting through the wooden doors, shaking off the sweat and spit of the dull streets within this space where time itself had stopped. Colour considered on canvas. Sharpened blends of rounded pigments, popping on wind-swept, weather-worn, heavy heads. Petals already peeled back to their pips, as if missing things like companions, connections, the right to be seen, an ear to be heard. Dutchman, drawing dying flowers in France. Choking at the dinner table and failing at everything in life, even at life. But for the canvas and its aging yellows burning into ochre, orange-coloured kisses and eager green stems holding hundreds of seeds, holding hope, resurrection, introspection. Bright mornings of soft butter caught in hayfields before the crows came. To London, too. Heavy strokes of paint, radiating like halos to fill in the hole left after all the lights went out. After all the feet continued up and over our bodies. Lying in the fields. Poetic peeps and gentle persons, in-betweeners and nonconformers, genders all and genders equal, we've reached the end of episode 4, season 8 of Eat the Storms, the poetry podcast. My name is Damien B. Donnelly, I've been your host and producer, and thank you so much for tuning in today, tomorrow, next year, or perhaps next month. Whether that has been on Spotify, Apple, Google, Breaker, Podbean, Player FM, Overcast, Pocket Cast, Castbox, Podcast Addicts, or iTunes. My glorious guests on today's show have been Sue Finch, Michael Dooley, Peter Lilly and Nancy Murphy. For details on all of my guests, please head on over to our website. That is www.eatthestorms.com. Click on the podcast section called Listen to the Podcast and there you will find a blog post for every episode. This, of course, was episode 4, season 8. And in that blog post, you will find bios, photos and social media handles so you can find, follow and be fans of all our guests today. Now, if you don't mind, please feel free, after listening to the podcast, to sing about it, to shout about it, to post about it. We are an international community and here at Eat the Storms, we realise that the spotlight can only truly give off enough warmth and light when it is shared with others. So please do us all a favour and share the hell out of this bloody poetic storm. The music on the podcast today was from purpleplanet.com and the podcast itself is produced on Spotify for Podcasters, formerly known as Anchor. Until the next time you tune your preferred podcast platform into your favourite poetry podcast, please do me a favour and never steer too far away from sweet treats, safe harbours, and yes, as always, ensure that you stay bloody poetic.
Oh, thank you.